begin. The second half of the course, which we started even though you haven't done the midterm yet, the second half of the course deals with more what we would call the history of biblical interpretation. In other words, until now we dealt with either looking at certain background issues of the text, authorship, pure textual issues. We did ancient Near East, which was really sort of an attempt to see how tools, certain kinds of tools, can illuminate the text. But now, we turn to the question of not so much our interpretation of the text, but how the text has been interpreted over the hundreds and thousands of years since the Torah was given. Not just the Torah, theoretically, but the rest of the books of Tanakh as well. Now, the way I structure the second half of the course, despite there's an error, definitely an error on the syllabus, it's broken into two and five lectures. We only have six lectures total left, so it's actually two and four. But they're really sort of, I break it down the next six classes into two parts. The first part is pre-Rishonim, and the second part is Rishonim. We'll spend at the end 3 weeks dealing with four major Mefarshim to introduce you to their perhaps general methodology: Rashi, Rashban, Ibn Ezra, and Ramban. And so that will be the last three classes. These three classes deal with earlier biblical interpretation, meaning earlier than Rishonim, primarily focusing on Targum. That will actually take up the lion's share. And we'll talk a little bit about Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, a little bit about Qumran, a little bit about other sources of exegesis, but primarily Targum. Okay? But it's certainly not the only one. So let me start by asking the following question. When does the history of exegesis — is just a fancy word, one you should know, meaning interpretation, okay, and an exegete is a mefarish. So when does the history of biblical exegesis begin? Answer? Ayo? No, doesn't. Well, in the minute after Har Sinai. The minute after Har Sinai. Now, you can take that in — and let me say, ask the second question. When does biblical exegesis end? Tomorrow? Ask me again tomorrow. Right, it never ends. And the point is, it's a continuous process. There is no end point to it. There is a beginning. I'm sorry? That in itself is dependent upon some biblical exegesis, which may or may not be the case. So, but neither you nor I will be around to find out about it. The beginnings of biblical exegesis obviously start immediately after the Torah was given. Why? Because every text demands interpretation. Even if you have a Torah Sheval Peh, which we do, and we have to discuss in a moment what was in that Torah Sheval Peh, and I might have discussed this already at the beginning of the semester, but I'm going to chazer it anyway. But even if you do, Torah Sheval Peh does not address every possible scenario. And hence, when one wishes to interpret the law for new situations, you need to engage in biblical exegesis. Now, the Rambam's position as to the origins of Torah Sheval Peh, or to the nature of Torah Sheval Peh, is to break it down into five categories. Two, which I always say are of no interest to me, not because they're not of interest to me, but they're not interest to me as categories. Two are things that are Drabanan, two different kinds of Din and Drabanan that he has, whatever they are. Three of them are the Oraisa. I mean, three of them have the status of being the Oraisa. Two of which come from Har Sinai, called the original Torah Sheval Peh, one of which does not, but it's still the Oraisa. The two which come Misinai are those things which are labeled, more or less, those things which are labeled Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. There obviously are some exceptions when the simple assumption is that when the Mishnah speaks in Yadayim about they wanted to know what maaser you separate in the Shemitah year in Amon HaMelech. The problem is that normally you separate Maaser Sheni, first, second, fourth, and fifth years. You separate Maaser Ani, third and sixth years. And in Shvias you separate no Maaser because all the produce is Hefty in Shvias. But because Amon HaMelech are from Chutz La'aretz, so therefore there is no Kedushas Aretz Min HaTorah, but the Chachamim instituted, the practice was to separate Trumas and Maaseras. And the question, and they didn't have Shvias enforced there. And the reason for that is so that the Jews in Eretz Yisrael would have a source of sustenance, the produce that was grown there. So the question is, once the produce that's grown there is not hefker, doesn't have the dinner pair of Shvias, so you separate from the Maaseres presumably. What Maaseres do you separate? It doesn't fit into any of the years of the cycle. And there was a discussion among the Tanaim Yadayim. It's a very famous Mishnah that's quoted in Chagiga in the first parak. Ein Beit HaMedrash B'lo Chiddush. That's not the Mishnah, but that's what the Gemara has there. And the conclusion, when they had this whole discussion, they reached the conclusion that the Maaseres Maaser Ani, when they came and told Rabbi Eliezer what had happened in the Beit Medrash, he said, you don't need all your fancy Torah, Mekubal Ani, you know, Ishmi Tish and Moshe Rabbeinu Halachim, Moshe Misinai, that Amon HaMoav Maaseres Maaser Ani B'Shvias. That's very interesting, but what does it mean, Halachim Moshe Misinai, the whole din, institution of Maaseres in Shvias, in Amon HaMoav is only the Rabbanan. Okay, so maybe that sometimes Halachim Moshe Misinai means firmly accepted halacha, firmly established halacha. At least in cases where it's clear it's not a din d'oraisa. But most of the halacha moshe misinai, the Rambam would assume that are in fact misinai. And what characterizes them as halacha moshe misinai is that there is no scriptural basis. There's no, it's not interpretation of a pasuk in the Torah, it's an independent law. For example, Misachamayim, Arava, Eser Netios, so these particular details or laws don't have, it's not that they're not interpreting a particular pasuk in scripture, the sort of independent institutions that exist in halacha moshe misinai or independent details of mitzvahs of the Torah which aren't found or hinted to in the Torah but are preserved or recorded or dictated halacha moshe misinai. The second category is what the Rambam refers to as perushim hamekubalim, received interpretations. The examples that he gives are pre-Eitz Hadar, meaning an Esrog, and that ayin tachas ayin is monetary, not actually an eye for an eye. Now, so those are interpretations they're interpretations of scripture. In other words, ayin tachas ayin being mamon is telling you how to read a certain pasuk. That a pre-Eitz Hadar is an esrog is teaching you how to read a certain pasuk. So those two categories, halacha moshe misinai. The Rambam asserts, or Misina, excuse me. The Rambam asserts that there is no machlokas by these dinim. You'll never find any machlokas. Forget the fact that empirically you do. That's his assertion. You never find a machlokas by halachim moshe misinai. You never find a machlokas by perushim hamekubalim. It's always, agreed upon. Now, why does he say that? Because the Rambam is polemicizing against the Gaonim. The Gaonim, who attribute a hoary antiquity to the Mishnah, at least back to the time of Ezra, are attempting to assert that all the dinim were basically already known. Then you have to explain, how do you get machlokas? And the way the Gaonim explain machlokas was that people forgot. People got confused over the traditions. And because they were confused over the traditions, so that's how you have machlokas. The Rambam abhorred such a possibility. He thought that was outrageous, that they should have forgotten so much. And he says, that anything that has a tradition, misinai, you never find machlokas. If you do find machlokas, Rambam says, that's because most of the dinim, he doesn't say it this way, but it's empirically, it's clear based upon the description. If you find machlokas, it's because when the Torah doesn't speak about a particular din, and you don't have halacha moshe misinai, and you don't have a perush hamekubal, so what you have to do now is engage in interpretation. How do you engage in interpretation? You either use Yud Gimel Midah Shatar Nitresh Espahem, you use Svara, as the Gemara in a number of places says, Kralam Ali Svarahi, and basically you interpret. Whose job was it to interpret? What's that? How do you know that? No, that's how you know it's not God's job to interpret. How do you know it's the base? What's that? No, but how do you know that it's the basin's job to interpret? I'll grant you it's not God's job. So the whole parsha, the whole piece in parsha is Shoftim, which is Ki Palemim Chadavar Lamishpat, Beinam Ladam Beinim Ladeve Negam Lanega. The basin Hagadol's function is depicted by the Torah as one not of an arbiter of facts, but an arbiter of law. Right? The issue was not, did Reuven kill Shimon, did Reuven not kill Shimon? It was Ki Palemim Chadavar Lamishpat, Din Ladin, Bein Dam Ladam Bein Negam Lanega. You needed to know a particular din. What do you do? You come to the Kohanim Alvim, Shofer Asher Bayim Lahemu, V'darashtav Higidu Lecha Eis Dvar HaMishpat. It's their responsibility to interpret Torah Shebichtav. So Rambam says that that's how you get Machlokes. Why? Because different people have different natures, different tendencies, different proclivities, and they see things in different ways. And once it comes to interpretation, two reasonable people can come up with sometimes two different interpretations. Now, once upon a time, Rambam says, you had a Sanhedrin, they used to take a vote when they had a debate, and whoever won, the majority opinion won, and that was the end of the matter. There were no machlokes. But Mishirabu Tamidei Shammai V'Hillel Shaloshim Shu Kol Sarkon, when you had the many Talmidei Shammai V'Hillel who didn't do something right, and the Rambam understands meant that they couldn't function as a unit to take a majority vote, or they couldn't agree on the ground rules of a majority vote. So then, Rav Samach Lokas be Yisrael. V'nasa Torah k'shtei Torah. So that's how Rambam understood that. Which means for the Rambam that any time you find a machlokas by a din d'oraisa, what is it? And again, it may be a little exaggerated, but not mostly exaggerated, not terribly so. When you find a din, a daraisa, about which is a machlokas in the Gemara, what does that tell you? I just said the Rambam found afford such a view. Yeah, but what does that mean about that particular law, y'all? It wasn't misina. It's a din to oraisa, but it's not misina. Now the truth is that the Rambam, I don't know, you know, I always heard this, Rashefka always quotes this Rambam. It's something of a radical notion to some. I think if you study the history, if you're going to study history of the Bayesheni period and the post-Bayesheni period, the classical period, it's the only assumption that makes any sense. It's the only assumption, the way the Rambam explains, that many of these dinim, most of these dinim are not misinai, but rather they're part of the natural growth and growth of Torah Shebaal Peh, the interpretation of Torah. Not only from a historical perspective, from a logical perspective, I think it's also the only position that makes sense. But otherwise the Torah would be a dead Torah. It would not be a living Torah. Yes?
What was going on before that time?
Before that time, may have been debates, but people resolved debates. Because they were able to function as a court, as a basin, and they solved they were machlokas, but they voted, and that was the end of the discussion. Right?
So
the problem, in other words, right, and then maybe either they forgot about the old machlokas, or, well, I shouldn't say that, because if it were recorded, that, when I say forgot, I don't mean they got confused, it means it stopped being an issue. Or better just said, yeah, there were new issues that came up. Now, I realize the Rambam's position taken hyper-literally is also not tenable, because it's inconceivable that some of these positions didn't come up earlier. So you're going to have, obviously, there's a position in between. But on the larger fact, you know, what the Rambam says that many of these dinim, that most of these dinim are not misinai, but rather are things that develop, on that point I think it's most likely clear. Not everything, but many things. What that means is that you have a lot of things that are d'oraisa that are not misinai. I know to some of you that sounds like a strange concept, but that's what the Rambam says. So in effect, that's the beginning of, so the beginning of Torah Shebaal Peh. The beginning of biblical exegesis, basically, is starts the day after Matan Torah. Now, the only difference, of course, early on is that Moshe Rabbeinu might have been able to consult with God, whereas no one else can. What that means for a postmodernist, I don't know, because obviously that assumes a certain original meaning, one meaning to the text. But certainly, after Moshe Rabbeinu's death, where consulting God is no longer an option, so then at that point you are now into the period of full-fledged biblical exegesis. I can't tell you how much they were doing in Bayis Rishon, how much halachic exegesis was going on. If you read Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Malachim and Sefer Yeshua Shoftim, you realize that there were a lot of not good things going on in the Bais Rishon period. What they were preoccupied with or why they were doing the things they were doing is certainly a question. But certainly, we already have the records of a good deal of biblical exegesis already from the late Bais Sheni period, middle to late Bais Sheni period. Now, the truth is, that is not true what I said. I've already given an example to the contrary. The first record of biblical exegesis we have is not found in the late Bais Sheni period. Where is it found? I think I said this already in the last couple of weeks, as we gave an example. Where are the earliest traces of biblical exegesis? That's biblical text. That's not biblical exegesis. Well, let me put it this way. You make an interesting comment in saying that. There's something you can learn from that, which is that they viewed it as having magical powers. But that's not a surprise either, that they should have seen Berachas Kohanim in that light. There was also a fragment of a pasuk from Dvarim, which was from the end of the Chanan. What is it? Anyone read about this? Shomer HaBris VaChesed. Shomer HaBris VaChesed. But that's not a real shock that you would use that in an amulet. Right? If you pick something, you were going to put in a Kamea. So I think Berachas Kohanim would be if you weren't going to put magical incantations, if you were looking at the scripture, that would be a good place to look. So that's the biblical text. What about biblical exegesis? What are the earliest biblical exegesis we find? That's laid by Yesheni, period, or something earlier. Asher? Unclus is, that's much later, that's post-Korban. Dead Sea Scrolls are earlier. Right. Unclus is a contemporary of Rabbi. Whatever Unclus exactly did, and we're going to talk about that, that's a contemporary, that's second century of the Common Era. There's something earlier. What? No, Ugaritic texts are maybe earlier than even Tanakh, but that's not biblical interpretation. That may provide you with data that helps you understand Sukkim, but that has no direct connection to Tanakh. It just stems from a similar milieu. A similar culture or whatever. So what's the earliest biblical exegesis? In Tanakh, you find. Now, we mentioned Divrei Hayyamim last week, the example of Vayivashlu Asa Pesach Ba'esh, which is an example of attempting to resolve a seeming contradiction between Shmos and Dvarim, or whether it's Vishal Tovi Achalta, or Kiyem Sliye Alo Soflo Menra Uvasham Musho Bamayim. That's one example. One other example, which is, I think, very interesting, which is a pasuk in Hosea. This seems to be a contradiction in the Torah who changed Yaakov's name. Right? First it says, "Vayomer shalcheni kelashacha, vayomer lo shalechacha, ki im be'arthani, vayomer lo nashamecha, vayomer Yaakov, vayomer lo Yaakov, vayomer shimchaki in Yisrael, ki sarisa im elokim v'im anashim v'tuchal." It seems that the angel changed Yaakov's name. Then, a few psukim later, 10-15 psukim later, God appears to him, right, so God appears to him and gives him the name. Now, you already may know the Medrash on this, in effect, which is that the angel was... the angel pleaded with Yaakov, God's going to come and change your name in Bethel, what are you doing to me now? Let me go. You may be familiar with that. In fact, that Medrash, in effect, is really just the pasuk in Hosea. The pasuk in Hosea, which reads, Vayasar ala malach vayuchal bacha vayishan en lo, Bethel yimsa'enu, b'sham yidaber imanu. Now, the pasuk is a little bit difficult, but it would appear that in fact is what the Navi is doing there. That, what's that? It's Hosea. We read it, I think, for Yetze, Yud Beis Hei. Rashi just quotes that pasuk, basically as the resolution between this seeming contradiction. So biblical exegesis goes back already to Tanakh itself. Later books of Tanakh in effect, may be interpreting sometimes earlier books of Tanakh. There certainly are references, and sometimes it's even interpretation. Okay. However, there's very little of that. Bottom line, there isn't that much. There is much more, once you get into the Bayesheni period, of what are major sources of interpretation in the Bayesheni period. So somebody's already mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls. What else do you have from the Bayesheni period? Not post-Khorban, but pre-Khorban. Are y'all? I'm sorry? You have Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. What else? You probably at least have done some of this in intellectual Jewish history. What else do you have besides Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha? You have Josephus and Philo. Okay, Josephus, what? I'm sorry? Sure. His major work, the longer work, if I'm not mistaken, is Antiquities of the Jews. That's like a whole retelling of all of Tanakh. You see tons of what you would recognize as Medrash is already found in Josephus, you know, Midrash HaGadah. Yeah, Simon?
Is that where it brings down about Teva?
About what?
Teva?
You mean where it still is or something like that? Probably, yeah. Yeah, it's in Antiquities. His other works, he has a few smaller works. The only one that's, I think, a significant size is the War. But basically, his major work, and this is seemingly, it's not clear whether it's written for Jews or non-Jews, you know, as a polemic to the pagan world, or really for internal purposes for Jews who were very Hellenized and only spoke Greek. Probably, I think we assume the former, but I'm sure it's not agreed upon by scholars. But the major work was Antiquities of the Jews. So, it's just because we have all that other material elsewhere, we don't have the history. He's the primary source for the history of the period. So you have Josephus, Philo, who's right, we have almost only Torah, no Nach. Josephus has everything, pretty much. But Philo is an Alexandrian. Josephus lived in Israel. He was part of the rebellion. He was one of the generals who was captured earlier, I think, in Yotzfata. What's that? He surrendered, yes. Yes, well, I mean, yes, he didn't fight them to the name, and they caught him anyway. He surrendered. So Philo was an Alexandrian Jew, a little earlier than Josephus, the earlier part of the first century of the Common Era. So that, again, you have Philo's biblical exegesis. We said Qumran. There is early rabbinic literature, but there's very little of it. What early rabbinic literature exists? No, nothing that we can really say that early, but individual maimros that are preserved in various collections of Divrei Chazal, which we can, I think, reasonably assume, in fact, faithfully represent the original statements of the authors until proven otherwise. For example, I suspect maybe the earliest statement preserved in rabbinic literature of a direct quote, of a verbatim quote, is the Mishnah found in the Seches Edios, Paraches Mishnah Dalet. It's basically all in Aramaic. Hey, Rabbi Yosef ben Yoezer, and he gives three dinim in Aramaic. And again, Shama, we have a few things attributed to Shammai and Hillel, not too many. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel may already be post-Korban. I mean, they start earlier, but a lot of the material, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, still seem to belong to Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, and they straddle Korban. You have material, a little bit of material in Avos, the Mishnah Chagiga of the Zugos, that's probably not a direct quote, but it's a summation, Lismok, Shalom Lismok. So you have a little bit of material preserved in Chazal here and there of late Bayesheni rabbinical figures. Okay. One more major source, Ayol, you should know, of biblical interpretation of the late Bayesheni period, it may start as early as the 3rd century before the Common Era, is the Septuaginta, the Targum HaShivim, the Greek translation. When I refer to the Greek translation, I refer to what we call the Septuagint, not the later revisions. That we'll talk about for a few minutes, probably at the end of, I guess, the third lecture, about what happened with the Septuagint, because of the many differences between the text of the Septuagint and the Hebrew text, or what seems to be the forlaga, the underlying text of the Septuagint, if you reverse translate it, and the Hebrew text. So there were revisions, there were at least three translations of the Greek that were redone from the Hebrew. And those look like our Hebrew text. One of them, by the way, is a nice segue, or not a segue, but it will be coming up shortly, will be, one of them was by Akilah. Okay. Now, post-Korban, what kind of material do we have, of material that's a biblical exegesis? Yes. Akilah. There were three revisions. I know, David's thinking, the gears are grinding there. Aquila, Theodotion, and Symmachus. Can you recognize, two of those names? Theodotion you won't recognize. The Symmachus is probably not the one you know, but that's the same as? No. Who is Symmachus? What is that name in Hebrew? Aramaic. Tsumchus, yeah. It's a Greek name. Anything, as a general rule, most of the time when something has Samas or Tessus in it, in the Mishnah, it's a Greek word. A Greek name. Tsumchus is a, Symmachus was one of the three, I don't know if he was Jewish or not, but was one of the three retranslations of the Greek. Do you recognize Aquila? Not that Tsumchus. The Symmachus who did one of the translations, I don't know whether he was Jewish or not. He translated the Torah back into Greek again. No, Rabbi Meir's Talmud we can safely assume was Jewish. There was more than one person named Symmachus in that period. It probably was a name of hundreds of people. Okay, I don't know what the Greek name means, but so what was it? What name do you recognize from Aquila? No. I don't know if it's related to that, but I don't know. It's not. I don't think so. Actually, I'm sorry. Aquilas Hager of the Yerushalmi, which looks an awful lot like what? Onkelos. Yeah, we'll talk about it. Anyway, so post Korban. Now let's go to post Korban. What biblical exegesis do we have post Korban? I think Mishnah is a form of biblical exegesis, but some could debate that. In other words, clearly it's not organized around. How many here have studied Medrash Halacha systematically at all? How many here of you have opened the Medrash Halacha? I know at least one of you has, but. What's that? Opened and read. What are the Midrash Halacha? I think I mentioned this before. Mechilta, Sifra, and Sifrei. Okay? So the Midrash Halacha are Tanaitic works, although they may be just a little bit later, certainly in their composition, in their redaction, not necessarily the material, a little later than the Mishnah. But certainly Midrash Halacha are biblical exegesis. The Mishnah is chosen in a different order. That's a big debate among scholars, which comes first, scriptural order or independent order. In my mind, there's no question that scriptural order comes first. That doesn't mean the Midrash Halacha are older than the Mishnah, but it means conceptually the way the earlier forms of study must have followed the text. So you have Midrash Halacha, maybe a Mishnah. What else? Well, what other sources of biblical exegesis? Yeah. Yes. Well, how do you know? I agree with you. No. I know how they derived halachos, but what was their method of transmission? Did they transmit an independent body independent of the text, organized by logical order, or did they sort of transmit it along with the biblical text?
No, what I mean is like the one day when how they decided to talk about it today, yeah.
But they in Gaonic Babylonia, which is where you're borrowing that definition, perhaps anachronistically from. So they had a curriculum. They didn't use the Chumash. So just as Tanaim had early collections of Mishnayos, you know, at least proto Mishnayos, you know, in terms of what compared to what we have, they had something which may have been organized and may not have been organized by text. By the biblical text. It might have been, you know, I assume at some point it clearly started with the biblical text. What? How do you have a Misaf HaShabbos? Do Misaf HaShabbos follow the biblical text? No. Yet you study it, right? The answer is the ordering is different. The organization and structure are different. What else do you have besides Mishnah and Midrash Halacha? You have Midrash Haggadah, which on the whole are later. The earliest collection is probably Gracious Rava, probably 5th century Eretz Yisrael. Yeah. Yeah. Tosefta, to the extent that you consider Mishnah commentary, Tosefta is it's a bigger stretch, but if you can consider Mishnah, Tosefta is mostly a commentary on the Mishnah, or using similar materials, whatever it is. What else? Okay, you have non-Jewish biblical exegesis, or depending on who was doing it, they might have been Jewish Christians. You have the church fathers and things like that who are also engaged in scriptural interpretation of what they would call, what we would call the Hebrew Bible. They would call it the Old Testament. We don't use that term. What else? Now somebody said, you can mention what you said earlier. the Targumim, okay, which presumably date from, as best we can tell, as we have them. I'm not going to state about the origins of theoretical Targum, date from Unklus, certainly is a contemporary. Unklus may, I don't think. What's that? Yonasan Ben Uziel is a little bit before the Korban. Okay, so you could have counted Targum Yonasan. Now, what do we have Targum Yonasan for? Not correct. That's correct. Did I say that, or you knew that from elsewhere? Tuf Yud, the Targum Yonasan that you find in the Chumash is clearly not Targum Yonasan, for many reasons, aside from the fact that the language is different than Targum Yonasan Nach. It's also pretty clear from the Gemara that they didn't have a Yonasan ala Torah. It's not explicit. It's explicit that there was no Yonasan on Ksuvim, but it's close to explicit, or strongly implicit, that there was no Targum of Yonasan either on Torah. Unklus did the Targum Shal Torah, Unklus Hagarim Oum, Pi Rabbi Yilez, Rabbi Yeshua, Targum Rishon Leviim, Yonasan Ben Uziel Amaro, Mipi Hanani Mishav Adar, Mipi Hages Hari Malachi, whatever that means. He never saw them, obviously. They were maybe four hundred plus years before he did. So Targum Yonasan could be, assuming what we have is actually the original Targum Yonasan, which is always a question. So that could be pre-Korban. I should point out the Amoraim speak about a Tosefta Ruchim Roshia. We have a Tosefta, but they're not the same thing. We have a Tosefta which is a collection of Brisos, Its origin is not entirely clear. What has been pretty clearly demonstrated by Albeck is that our Tosefta is not the one that the Gemara refers to as the Tosefta of Chaim Roshai. That you can, there are ways to demonstrate that. In the same sense, the Targum we have, which is called Targum Yonasan, I'm not saying there's any reason that we should think it's not necessarily, but it doesn't have to be that Targum. We know that there was a Targum on Nevi'im by Yonasan, whether we have or not. We are pretty sure there was neither on Torah nor on Ksuvim. It's very clear from the Gemara. What happened with the Targum Yonasan on Torah is that it was abbreviated Taf Yud, which is for Targum Yerushalmi, which is what it is. It's an Eretz Yisrael Targum. And somebody mistakenly unabbreviated it or expanded it at some point, Taf Yud to Targum Yonasan. Okay. What else do we have? One major source that you left out for biblical exegesis, yeah, Babli, especially Yerushalmi as well. Okay, now, and you've already mentioned Midrashi Agada. Fine, that's sort of what there is out there. And sometimes, you don't realize that something is in fact biblical exegesis. Sometimes you don't realize it because you're not alert to it. Sometimes. Because Chazal do things in very interesting ways. There's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah which said that at the time of the Mabul, so God decided, God took two stars out of, I think, Kima or Seal or something, what's that? Kima, it would have been Kima. And placed them, whatever, he used them, and he unplugged them or something like that. You get this Medrash about, and he turned, and the hours that the sun and the moon no longer function, and so on. Sounds like a nice Medrash, right? It happens to be, it's biblical exegesis. You have a pasuk, there's two similar pasukim, I think they're both in Amos. But one of them is, Osei Kima Ukasil, Vofech, and I'm leaving certain things out, Vofech Laboker Samaves. Something b'yom l'layla hechshich ha'korei l'mei hayam v'yishpachem apanei haaretz Hashem shema. What's that? The Gemara doesn't quote the pasuk. The Gemara Rosh Hashanah just states it as an agada, when in fact what it really is just an interpretation of that pasuk in Amos. This is a paper that's worth writing, but I only have a couple of examples right now, and it's been on my mind, where you find that Chazal will use motifs, almost present an agada, which is really a running interpretation of a pasuk, but they don't cite the pasuk at all. Most of the time, Chazal quote the pasuk they're interpreting. Here it's not, but it's in the background. But many things that you come not to realize, many agados, not all, are in fact biblical exegesis. Take, for example, and we may discuss a little more in a couple of weeks, the Agada of the Kirshan HaEsh, which is already found. Does anyone know where it's first found? It's found something similar in the Book of Jubilees. Another question, David?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Why would the Chachamim quote the pasuk if they were interpreting it? I mean, I'm sure that Rashi on the pasuk or the Dak on the pasuk over there will quote the.
No, I don't think they do. I don't think they do. Why Chazal were playing? They didn't need to. They assumed you knew. You look at the Gemara and you'll decide whether I'm correct or not. But I think you'll look at the Gemara and decide that there's no other way. That's what Chazal had in mind. They didn't have to. They knew these something. They knew the back and forth. So it was natural. You know, some of the original audience was rabbinic or, you know, were Bikim and Tanakh. They knew what the reference was.
Why don't the Rishon quote it?
Two possibilities. One is because they thought it was obvious too, because it didn't occur to them. It's not necessary for understanding the Gemara. It's very fascinating that, you know, here they're really engaged with biblical close to Jesus. And, you know, I haven't checked to say, maybe next Shaviyah they quote the passage, but I don't, you know, certainly in the printed text it's not there. Now, is the Kivshana Ish biblical close to Jesus? I would agree with your answer if you just took away one word. Not. Absolutely is. Okay, so that. But more fundamentally,
it's an explanation why Adam's coming at this point.
And why you didn't say the question
and
right?
Why doesn't know it?
Well, yes. More. Why does God choose Abram? Why did God choose Abram? That's the question. Well, the point is you're trying to explain why Avram was such an unusual individual. That's correct. All that is meant to explain a basic lacuna. Asher, you're correct. I think it should be formulated that, you know, why did God choose Abraham? Right? There happen to be different traditions on this. If I'm not mistaken, did the Rambam not say in some way that Avram was thrown into jail? As opposed to the Kishon Eish? There are alternative versions of this story. Now, I know that would be very disappointing because, of course, the alternative versions raise a fundamental question. Which if you understand that Agada properly, you know on your own anyway. But we'll talk more about that when we get to Agada. What's that? Did the Agada happen?
No.
Was Avram actually thrown into the Kivshan Eish? I agree. I think it doesn't make a difference. He says it was the Vayera piece. He says was in a vision. Yes, but somehow that I don't know if it's disturbing to some people if you tell them the Kishon Eish never actually happened. If you were to assert that, now,
yeah. Okay.
You think you agree, Alan? It's more disturbing.
Yeah, why would Abraham just chosen out of?
Well, let me just explain. God had a good reason. We may or may not have it. I'm not just pointing. We're going to talk about Agada within a class or so. We'll come back to that. I want to really start focusing on Targum, and then we'll spend more time on how the Rambam for one understood Agada. I don't remember. I think it's on the syllabus. There's a long passage in Chelek, and it's in the Perashah Mishnayis. Before he gets to the Yud Gimel Ikrim, I believe, I think it's before, when he talks about the three Kitim who understand Agada, he has one of the greatest lines there. When he talks about the intelligent people, the one who understand it properly, he said the third Katan, if you can call something a Katan when it only has like a single individual in it, just like you can call the sun, I think what he calls it, you know, if you can call the sun a Min, in his terms the sun was unique, there was only one of it. Right, so in that sense, you can call this third group a cat as well. He didn't have generally a high regard for the intellectual talents of the many, even those who thought themselves to be intellectual. So we'll come back to that. We'll come back to the Rambam. But in the meantime, let's talk about Targum. Okay, and Targum potentially in your lifetime can be a very in your studies can be a very valuable tool for two reasons. Number one, it's a source of interpretation. And number two, if you practice reading the Targum, you'll get very good in Aramaic. And that will help you a lot when you learn Gemara and other things related. I I developed my Aramaic because my Rebbe in 11th grade insisted that every week we had to do Shnei Mikra Vecha Targum with Rashi and Unklus, and we had questions when we came in on Sunday morning. He's one of the Rosh Yeshiva here now, one of the prominent Rosh Yeshiva. And because we had to do that, and if you notice the assignment I sent out, there were two approaches. Some people went the cheap way, and they got the Yain HaTov, which is a sefer which pulls out the places where Unklus and Yerushalmi or Yonasan. We call that Targum pseudo Jonathan because it's attributed, but it's not. It wasn't a fraudulent attribution. It was just a mistake. Yain HaTov. I sent you the call number and email. The Yain HaTov, good one. Okay, it should be the Yain HaTov actually. No, Yain HaTov. Well, no, it could be either actually. The Yain of good. So anyway. It is. Okay, it is Yain HaTov. He takes out all those psukim where Unklus doesn't. He only quotes those psukim where Unklus doesn't translate literally. So when you do things that way, and he translates into Hebrew what Unklus wrote. So basically, you get the interpretations of Unklus. But some of us who didn't have access to the Sefer or weren't going to get access to the Sefer, well, we just read Unklus. And if you know the psukim already, or you know the psukim reasonably well, or you go back and look at the psukim, and if you know Hebrew, that's an assumption, basically Hebrew. So now, by doing that, you get the flavor of Aramaic. Because if you see the word Vayomer, or Vayidaber, and the first word in Unklus is Umalel, so after you've seen it six times, you know you can, without having to see it, tell you that the verb mem lamin lamin in Aramaic means the same as the word to speak, dalet beis resh in Hebrew, and so on and so forth. So for those of you who are willing to put in a little bit of time on a weekly basis, you can really do yourself a tremendous favor. I'm not going to do you the favor by giving you bechinam, but you can actually contribute greatly to your own development by doing that. So anyway, it's very rare. It's an archaic Hebrew. It's on poetry. Right. Well, it's both going to be in archaic parts and later. It's an Aramaic influence. So that's Sefer Tehillim, right? Does anyone know where that word occurs in the Torah? Only once, I think. Good. Mimi Lel Abraham, I need to understand, but that's poetry. So you get things that tend to be an Aramaic influence or tend to appear in two things. Things that are late, or relatively late, and things that are archaic. Okay, poetry. Fine. So, let's talk about Unklus some. And we'll focus most of our energy on Unklus. We'll do some reading of Targumic text. The origin of Unklus according to the Gemara. According to the Babli, I should say. Let's start with source A. It's in your reader, I think. Megillah 3a, which is... I don't know, where is it? I'm not reading off the reader. 22. Okay, why is that so early? Oh, they put that because that was for previous. That was membership, Nesama Shabaluchas. So the Gemara is there already. So go to Dav Gimel Amid Aleph. Who would like to read for me? Asher. Do you have a Bar Ilan on your computer? No. Okay, go ahead. The Amar of Yirmiyavi Tamer of Yechiyah Barabba. No, Unklus Hager Amar of Yipi Rabbi Yavis and Rabbi Yoshua. He recited over from Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yoshua. Okay. So Targum Shel Torah colon Yonasan ben Uziel Amoro. He recited it. Chagai Chaya Malachi. Who were they? No, that's Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. They were the last three Nevi'im. So, may have books of Tanakh named after them in Trasher. So, Chagai is Chayyim Malachi, So the Yonasim ben Aziel lived when? He was a Talmud of Hillel HaZaken. Shmonim Talmidim Hayilal Hillel HaZaken. Shloshim Roish Tamal Lahem Chama. Was it no? Shloshim Roish Shetinasan and Torah Kemoshe Rabbeinu and Shloshim Raimim Shetamal Lahem Chama Keshubinun and Esrim Beinunim. The Godel Shubahen was the Yonasim ben Aziel. The Katan Shubahen was Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai Shehaya Shoneh Mikra Mishnah Tosefta, Sifras Mechotas Estadamachot Sifras Sifrei Davar Gadol Davar Katan Masa Merkava Masa Bracious. Okay, and when by Yonasim ben Aziel, when he used to be studying Torah, so the birds flying overhead would be burned. I'm not here to discuss this very fascinating agada. Although I will confess my mild skepticism that Yochanan ben Zakkai could have been the least of the 80 Talmidim, but hey. But anyway, that's pretty astounding, certainly. But Yonasim ben Aziel, clearly, one thing you walk away from this Haggadah, however much it's Haggadah, however much it's history, is that Yonasim ben Aziel was a Talmud of Hillel HaZaken. You can date Yonasim ben Aziel with confidence. I'm sure he was a very fine Talmud of Hillel HaZaken as well. But you can date, what's that? We know that Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai might have been recovered, but it doesn't say. Presumably, that's what he was doing when the birds got burnt. So bottom line is, for our purposes, Yonasim ben Aziel lived after Hillel. When did Hillel live? So, anybody here learn the first parak in Shabbos? There's one Gemara you have to know if you do history. A very important Gemara in terms of dating Hazal. It's important to know also for knowing who Tanaim are in the Mishnah. Hillel, the Shimon ben Ovi, Gamliel ben Ovi, Shimon ben Ovi, Nogin, Asiyus, and Meir Shana, Kodim, Rabayis. The chain, if you want to know the chain of Tanoim, starting with Hillel, the children, the Siyim, his son, his son was Shimon ben Hillel. Shimon was the Nasi after Hillel. Up until Hillel, it wasn't inherited, right? It didn't follow family, right? It started out as that of Yosef and Yehoshua, and then. Who was the second one I remember? The Shmaya Nechai and Hillel Shammai. The last two, Shimon Mitzhatach and Huben Nechai, were the third, and the second, Nitai Harbeli and somebody. No, I don't remember. Whatever it is, so you look in the Mishnah Avos and the Mishnah Chagiyah, you get the Zugos. Then Hillel's son became a Nasi after him. The son of Shimon ben Hillel was Rabban Gamliel. You know that Rabban Gamliel was. That's Rabban Gamliel Hazakin or Rabban Gamliel the first. Okay, his son was the Nasi at the time of the Churban and the Sarug and Malchus for Shimon. Okay, that was from Shimon Gamliel the first. Okay, there's no way to know in the Mishnayos when it's Rashbag the first and Rashbag the second. There, if he's arguing with Rebbe, then you know it's the second. But anyway, after him, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai seemed to have occupied the Nasiut for a short period. Whether that was political of the Romans, we don't really know. I'm sure it's been written about a lot. After Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, the Nasi replaced him was Rabban Gamliel. This is Rabban Gamliel Hasheni of Yavne, the one who got into the fight with Rabbi Yoshua and got at least temporarily deposed. After Rabban Gamliel of Yavne was his son, who was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, for whom probably most of the references in the Mishnah refer to. And I suspect it's about him that the comment the Gemara has that Kolmachum Shoshana Rosh Hashanah Rosh Hashanah Alachim Tamoso Chutzmei Erev Tzid and Rayachon is probably the second Rashbag. Of course, the answer that the Rishonim can always use to get out of not following that name when we don't follow that particular line in the Gemara is, it's the other Rosh Hashanah Gamliel. But anyway, and the son of the second Rosh Hashanah Gamliel was, he already was an Usha, was? No, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. You find it frequently in Bryce's arguing with his father. When you see someone arguing with Rebbe, so you know that's Rosh Hashanah Al-Sheni for sure. So anyway, Hillel was Nag Nasius on Me'ah Shana Kodem Abayis, which places Yonasim ben Uziel, which is about 30 years before the Common Era, a contemporary of, we call him Herod the Great, he should probably be called Herod the Nuts, but he was contemporary of Herod, and I'm sorry? And he only got Herod the Great because Josephus seems to be an admirer of that warped and twisted man, but anyway, so he was so Yonasim ben Aziel was a contemporary, probably lived at the end of Herod's reign, at the turn of the Common Era. When did Haggai's Chaya Malachi live? Well, if you follow Chazal's chronology, you'd have to place it around the year 340, 350. If you follow, I'm not going to talk about the dating issue, but it's actually established with fairly hard evidence that Chazal, for whatever reasons, knowing or not knowingly, we're not counting the Persian period of 200 years, by the fact Haggai's Chayim Malachi lived in the late 6th century, maybe early. What's that? And only beginning of Bayis Sheni. Haggai's Chayim Malachi. Just read the Navi. The primary purpose of Haggai's Nevuah was chastising them for not building the Beis Hamikdash properly. They were building their own houses, but there were, while there were karbanos being brought in the Makom HaMikdash, there was no real, you know, Yan Beisi Hu Harev Atem Ratzim Mishle Beisel. But it's clear that is the end of prophecy, really. Haggai's Chayim Malachi. So they lived about 450 to 500 years earlier than Jonas and Menuziah. So one approach, of course, would be to say is that it means that that they lived a really long time, but we have no reason to think that. Or that Jonas ben Uzziel lived a really long time, and then it would have been strange that he would have been a Talmud of Hillel HaZaken if he was born 400 years before Hillel HaZaken, even if he did live into Hillel HaZaken's time. So obviously when it says Amaru Mipi, it means recited traditions attributed to, that's how we translate it, based upon their traditions. In the same sense that Achilas Hager, Unklas Hager, you know, it was interpreting, producing a targum following the traditions of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Now, what I presume that means, based upon comments of Rashi and the Gemara in Kiddushin, is that there were traditions, and we know this is true, of how to interpret, how to translate certain psukim. How do you know that from the Mishnah? Did any of you ever learn Mishnayos Brachos? Okay. So the truth is, that may or may not be targumic, but that already should hint to you. When the Mishnah says, HaOmer Al-Khan Tzipar Yagyu Rachamecha. So, where would you say, what do you envision that being? A guy gets up in shul, and between Ashrei and the next Haluk, he says, Al-Khan Tzipar Yagyu Rachamecha. Who says Al-Khan Tzipar Yagyu Rachamecha? Now, the truth is, the Mishnah is evidence that there were people who were saying it. The question is, where were they saying it? So I'll tell you. If you turn, hold on, I think it's here. You know, you go down to West 4th Street sometimes, or other places in New York City, you get these guys standing on the soapbox in the corner and preaching the gospel or something like that. Is that what we envision here? This guy was standing on the corner in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem street, saying, I can't see your home. No. That's modem. Yeah, you've extrapolated from one to the other. So hold on. Please. Just be patient. Please be patient. Now he doesn't have this. He doesn't have. Okay. So I can take a pretty good guess, by the way, where that came from. But give me one more second. There's one other thing I want to just check, and I'll read to you. But this one doesn't refer to. In the Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel, and again, you know, I mean pseudo Jonathan. And again, pseudo is not meant to be pejorative. It just means it's not his. Okay. So the beginning of the parasha of Sharo Chesef Oeis. Ami b'nei Yisrael Heichma, which means Heich, Da'avuna and Rachamin b'shmaya, just as God is merciful in heaven, Tehavon Rachmon in Biara, you should be merciful on earth. Tarta or Rachela Yasavi Yaspara Lotichsun Biyomahad. This is the same thing as Alkan Sipur Yagi Rachamah. Where was I reading from? I have a question for you. Do you know what Akdamus is? What is Akdamus? What is it? Some guy had nothing better to do with his time, so he just decided he'd write on me a poetry because I had nothing better to do. What is that thumbs? Where do you say, when do you say that thumbs in short? Yeah, you say it before. What learned before? Do they call up the coin? Or they wait? Every shul calls up the coin. You know, in some shuls, I don't know if I've never been in one, but I'm told. In some shuls, you know what they do? The coin makes breakfast. And then you read out notes.
Oh,
Strange. You know what Thomas is? It's an introduction to the Targum. Frequently on Yom Tovim, on special occasions. And Sharaf has some ways, by the way, is a special occasion. What's a special occasion?
Not somebody's bar mitzvah and parshas and more. When is Sharaf? On Yom Tov. So just 2 days for Chutzlars. Pesach the second day. So before reading the first pasuk in Targum, probably after they read the first pasuk, the Meturgaman would start and launch into this poetic introduction. That's a short one. I can show you much on this one. I just read you a short one. Adamus. What is Adamus about? What is the poem about? It's in praise of Torah. Praise of Torah. Right? A praise of the Kadosh Baruch Hu giving us the Torah. Very appropriate for which Yom Tov? Shavuos. If you were Meturgaman, you would have likely picked that dumb, you would have composed, you might have composed it on the spot. Maybe you composed it a previous year. You would have recited in that domus while the Balabatan were traveling away in shul. No, this is the only way they understood anything. It's just this they liked. So anyway, there are traditions people have how to interpret psukim. This is a case where there were traditions of using long introductions. Anyway, in this particular case, it said that we'll talk about this a little more, okay? But that's what Akdamus is. At least not much you remember, I suspect, even if you know nothing else when you leave the class. At least you understand what Akdamus is. So Yonah Semeluzio recorded traditions of how to interpret certain sukkim, perhaps, in the name of Chagai's Harim Malach. Yes. For what I just read, it says, my people, my nation of Israel, just as your father is merciful in heaven, so too you should be merciful on earth. It's interpreting that pasuk, the prohibition of slaughtering a mother, an animal, and its offspring on the same day, as mercy of God. Just like Akan Sipar Yagir Rachamecha. I'm not not surprised.
But the Gemara says not.
That's correct. So now you're asking the question. Forget the Zohar for the moment, okay? I give you two teirutzim on the Zohar, okay? One, it was written by Rishon Bar Yochai, and therefore he was a Tana and he disagreed with the Gemara or the Mishnah. Two, it was written by Moshe Ben Leon, and a lot of things in the Zohar don't necessarily correspond with the Gemara. Either way, it doesn't matter, right? Bottom line is that's something to be observed, but you're now asking the fundamental question, what do you do with the Targum? You know, the Gemara says, the Mishnah says in Megillah, if I'm not mistaken, unless it's a Brisa, that you're not allowed to translate in Mizarachalo Sitain Lahavir Lamola, that you shouldn't give from your seed to impregnate a Gentile woman who will have a child for Avodah Zarah. Now you appreciate the great punning of the language there. Umizarachalo Sitain Lahavir, and you read it not Lahavir to pass through, but to impregnate, Lashon Uberes, Lamola, okay? So that you're not allowed to do that. When I open my Targum, Yonasan ben Uziel, maybe you really want me to be calling, you're going to want me to call the pseudo Jonathan in some forgery. So when I read this here, if I'm not mistaken, let's see, what does he say? The end of Parashas Achrimos, I think that one is. He says, so Uminzaracha lo sitain bish tashmishta. Okay, it certainly sounds as if he's reading as you shouldn't give over your tashmish in order to. It's a little unclear what tzeid bas amamin is, maybe, but it means bas amamin is clearly a Gentile woman. Lemeabra means to impregnate for avodah zarah. Right, the child born will be an idolater. It's Achrimos, Yudches Chavalos. The Gemara even quotes a brisa just like this. The Gemara just says, Kagombis, as if it were quoting contemporary interpretations. As I'm more quoting, I mean, the fact that the Mishnah says you don't do this tells you there were people who were doing it, right? It wasn't purely a random, you know, they didn't just pick an idea, oh, don't read this way. Not that everybody's read this way until now. It's like generally not a good idea. If you don't want to give people a bad idea, don't tell them about it, okay? So, anyway, there were traditions and debates of what you should do and shouldn't do. Okay. Anyway, so now we have the second story. Let's read through it quickly and then we'll come back a little bit. All right, Yonah Simon Ziel, go ahead. I'm sorry? Nizdaza means to tremble. You know when we say be'ema be'yira be'retes u'be'zea, what does that mean? Yeah, it doesn't mean sweating. You might translate zia as opposed to zea. Zea is sweat, zia is trembling. Okay, I'm sure they were sweating too, but that's not what their word means. Okay, but lo kam v'lo zdom imenu. That means not to move. Okay? So nizdaza eretz Yisrael, ramez parsa, ramez parsa. Kilisi. So the Yubim Machlokas be Yisrael had him in Perush Pesukim. Then the Ode.
Over in the case of the Gala Tigers of Susan,
He didn't mean that. Legalos meant to, and he knew how to translate, but it meant to actually. But anybody, presumably he read the. What's that? Yeah, I mean he didn't produce it. The first one is, Amaro means he produced a formal targum that was used, that was publicized. Okay? Enough. So the Gemara explains why does it think that it was too much? It was already enough. Yishum. Okay. Now, where Sefer Daniel? And presumably, whatever you do, this took him at the end of Daniel. That's where the end of days is revealed. Fine. They want that revealed. Okay. That's what the Babli has. I'm more interested in focusing on Unklus for the moment. So Unklus again, my Pirav Zev Yeshua. What does the Yushalmi say? The Yushalmi is, I have a Yushalmi, you must also. The Yushalmi is, there it is, 1-9. It should be the preceding source, 19. Let me make sure. It's page 20 in the Yushalmi. And the bracket review, the second bracket, so the Yom Yom Hashem. Yeah.
The Yom Yom Hashem when you are
Bar Abba, yeah, okay. That's how Yushalmi drops Aleph all over the place. Standard. Yof Yofis Nibnei Adam. Okay. Does this say the same thing as the Babli? I don't know. It sounds an awful lot like the Babli, doesn't it? It's Akilas instead of Unklus, which is probably just a linguistic variant. Okay? It's not surprising that Akilas is closer to the Greek Akila because Greek was spoken there, so that's where it was. What? Sumchus didn't change his name. I mean, that's a modern assumption. I know that was always the case. I'm not aware of any indication in the Gemara of changing of names for Gerus. We do it, but not clear to me they did. And so there's no evidence that I'm aware of. So Akila is in fact, Unklus is just an effect called a corruption, a verbal corruption of Akilas. Okay, who was sort of the author? In this case, it's not the source for the Targum, but he recited the Targum over in the presence of? No, Yirmiyah is just quoting the tradition. Okay, does that fit with what the Babli says? Yeah, Rabbi Yehoshua. Now, What translation is this referring to in the Yerushalmi? What's that? No, Rashi. The Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua said, Yofi Yofis, they praised him. Yofi Yofis, the beauty. Yeah, so what Targum is this referring to? What language is this? Achilles of the Gersh translation? Yeah, Yofi Yofis, the Menei Adam, Yach, the Lekim Leyefes, Chazal, Sum, but the Babli and Yerushalmi has, the Tanaic sources, that Yef Yusuf Shal Yefes is Greek. What's that? So what's going on here? But no, that's, we know what this is. The Yerushalmi Zarmans, we know. This is the Greek revision of Achilles. Okay, so one possibility is that he wrote two Targumim. Okay, now methinks that unlikely that the same person wrote two, excuse the Popeye-ish language there. Okay, I think that it's unlikely that this would be the case for the following reason. If Achilles was a ger, his natural language was probably what? Greek. And it's unlikely he'd be writing a Targum in Aramaic. It'd be likely he'd write a Targum in Greek.
He first wrote it for the people in Greek, and then when he came to Israel, he wrote it in Aramaic for the people in Israel.
Okay, so I can only, you can speculate as much as you like. It's possible. It's possible there are two Targum, and it's also possible it's two people. Two different people. That's possibility one. That's the one you naturally gravitate for. However, from a historical perspective, if you've ever studied and compared Babli and Yerushalmi, there are two other possibilities that should be considered. Number one is that there's a debate between the Babli and Yerushalmi as to what exactly he did. The people in Eretz Yisrael thought it was their Greek Targum. The Jews in Babel thought it was their Aramaic Targum that he did. Possibility three, which in a sense is just a variant of that, maybe it's a, call it a less frum variant of that, but this, and every, I guess the more often I see this and think about it, the more I think it's likely, even though it doesn't disturb me. If you've studied enough Babli Yerushalmi, it won't surprise you at all. But in fact, this is a tradition from Eretz Yisrael that made its way to Babel and was sort of reinterpreted in the process or over the course of time. Meaning, in Babel, they had an Aramaic Targum. And they had a tradition from Eretz Yisrael that Achilas recited the Targum Yifi Rabbi Eliezer Rabbi Yeshua, and they assumed that this was a reference to their Targum, hence it got its name Targum Onkelos. So if that is the case, if that's in fact what happened, then it means our Targum Onkelos is in a sense misnamed. In other words, what Onkelos Hager really did, or Achilas Hager really did, is he really wrote the Greek Targum that the Yerushalmi refers to. There was another Targum from Jewish circles, probably our Targum or Onkelos, which was floated around, which got labeled like that. In the same sense, I know why one disturbs you more than the other, but in the same sense, nobody's disturbed by the fact that the Pseudo-Jonathan is not Targum Yonasan, it's Targum Yerushalmi. I understand why this would disturb you a little more, but it may be a similar kind of phenomenon. Not an abbreviation phenomenon, but a similar type of thing. But if you prefer to assume that there were two Targumim, or that it was a Machlokas Babli Yerushalmi, that's okay also. Those are the possibilities that are out there. What Nafkamina does that have in a certain sense? The answer is none, because both Targumim are valuable sources of biblical interpretation, and we can assume that both Targumim are the products of Jews. Now, I'm reserving comment as to whether one would ever read, and one might, a non-Jewish commentator on Tanakh. Some of them would actually have useful things to say. Even some of the church fathers, although probably we would not be that interested in what they had to say, except for historical purposes, because their interpretations aren't necessarily going to be so novel or needed. But certainly, if you're studying the history of interpretation, that's important. But regardless, one is going to study Targum Onkelos the same way, whether it was Onkelos Hager or whether or not it was the Jewish Targum of Babel, and it was later sort of attributed to Onkelos. Either way, I don't have a vested interest in one way or the other. So if you prefer one way, you can opt for one way. But those are the possibilities, the obvious possibilities at least. A couple interesting sidebars. Rashi in Kiddushin writes that the Targum of Onkelos is Halacha L'Moshe Misinai, meaning that this Targum, the contents of this Targum, it doesn't say that. It's apparently a tradition also of Rav Nachshon Naigon, I believe. Rav Nachshon Naigon. I guess if you're not, if you learn that Hilchos Shabbos, he gets quoted a number of times in the Torah. So there is a Gaonic tradition about this. The Rashi quotes. on that Gemara in Kiddushin, Adatim Tesamet Aleph, but it doesn't seem to fit with the Bali. The Bali doesn't say the Targum is Halacha Moshe Misinai. Okay. In fact, what happened to our Targum? The Gemara, we just skipped the line, but the Gemara asked the question on our Targum. How can you say that our Targum was Unkos Ager? They speak about a Targum in Sefer Ezra. Right? Or the Chazal interpreted Pasuk in Sefer Ezra, referring to the fact that they were targeting the Pasuk. So what's the Gemara's answer in Megillah? Shachum v'chazru v'yisum. They forgot. There was in Ezra's time, but they sort of forgot it and they reestablished it. In the case of the Targum, it seemed to make perfect sense. In other words, there was a Targum, there was a tradition of interpretation in Ezra's time, sort of it was formally lost, and it was reconstructed, or a new tradition was created. At least in that I got that it can be read that way. It doesn't have to be read this way, but... okay, yes, question Daniel? Or? Okay. Now, a couple of comments about the language of Unklus. Targum Unklus reflects what they refer to as standard literary Aramaic. It happens to be a fairly easy form of Aramaic. It is not the same, not identical. I mean, it's different than the Bavli of, than the Bavli's Aramaic.
More
people,
well,
the...
Yes,
the Bavli contains somewhere between 50 and 70% Hebrew, and the rest Aramaic. Targum Unklus is all Aramaic, basically. So, but even the Aramaic sections, it's not the same Aramaic. There's obviously a considerable degree of overlap. If you're very comfortable in Unklus Aramaic, you'll have a much easier time doing Bavli Aramaic, but you're still going to encounter difficulties, things that you wouldn't see in Unklus.
I didn't exactly understand the question in Megillah, simply because it doesn't say that Unklus was created it, and they said it in the key.
So the Gemara understood that to mean that Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua were its creators. Or that, or the way the Ushami would have Unklus was its creator with the approval of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Yeah, Aaron?
Right. Mark references which says the Ushami for
Targum. Yeah.
So I know that the most people say that if you use Judah in another language, but I know that most people say that just Unklus, not because it's like some sort of Kedusha. If you read it in English, you would not have that sort of Kedusha as you get Unklus is reading.
And Unklus, you mean a translation of Unklus in English?
No, you read Unklus better than reading English.
Well, yeah, but the assumption is because Unklus contains things that are not contained in a literal translation. Now, the point is that Unklus, if you look at that Gemara in Kiddushin, we're not reading that in the Testament off, you'll see that the way Rashi and Tosfos understood is there are things that there are parts of Unklus that are not purely literal. And therefore, by doing Unklus, one captures that. Anyway, so that's why Unklus occupies something of a special status. In the same sense that the Machaber writes, I do not mistake, he'd use Rashi. Right? Because in other words, there's an assumption that you want to have the literal interpretation, but plus. Okay.
Maybe also this means it was approved by some very important people. They said it before them and they erased it.
Well, again, but what were Targumim? What were Targumim? Targumim were used originally, most of them, not all of them, but most of them were used liturgically. They were used in the Beis HaKnesses. People did not read from a text. That did not exist. Written Targumim were generally not there of the day. There was a case of written Targum. The Tosefta in Shabbos about the Sefer Ir of Kasa Targum. It's quoted, it should be quoted in Kol Kisvei. It's a very important Tosefta for a number of reasons. So there they talk about a Targum Shel Yield. We also, at Qumran, we actually have, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have, I don't know what else we have a Targum for, but we have an Aramaic translation of Yield from Dead Sea Scrolls. But Mitzvogimanim used to get up there and they would freelance. So there were certain
things
on what they would add as interpretation. That's why you get the Mishnah saying some things you're not allowed to do. You can't say, I can't see Per Yagir Hamecha. Right, that's addressed to the Mitzvogimanim. Presumably more learned than the average person because they knew the biblical Hebrew well enough to translate. Well, yes. In other words, they did not want, when they were so opposed to it, they didn't want certain things being done in a public forum. Just as the Mishnah Megillah says, we don't translate certain passages in the Torah. The question of Maisa Ruben is Nikrav Alamitargim, and Masi Yehuda is this, and Masi Yehuda Rishon. Right? Those are liturgical decisions. There are some issues Chazal did not want necessarily discussed in public. And if you didn't translate in Aramaic, so most of you Jews would not understand. They would just hear the Torah being read. And certain additions, certain choices of interpretation the Chazal were opposed to, and the Mishnah was opposed to. Okay. Now, Unklus became so canonical that in Babel you have a Masorah on Unklus, actually. Just as you have a Masoretic tradition on the Torah, counting how many times words appear, you have the same thing in Unklus, interestingly enough. Not as developed and expanded as we have in the Torah, but it became so canonical and so widespread that they actually have a Masorah on Unklus. Characteristics of Unklus, very briefly. We've discussed the origin of the Targum. It's a very literal Targum. When you read, I think I still have you reading an essay by Alexander Sperber. He put out the volumes of the basic Targumim in critical editions on Unklus, and I think of Yonason also, and some stuff on Ksuvim. So I think I gave you at least one of Sperber's things to read. So he talks about a type A Targum and a type B Targum. A type A Targum is a kind of a Targum where if you stripped away all the Agadic editions, if there are any, you would wind up with a word-for-word translation of the biblical text. A type B Targum, which are rare, the only one I know of is Targum Esther, Targum Hasheni on Esther, is where if you took away all the Agadas, you wouldn't even necessarily be left with the biblical text. So those are rare, but it's a much more expansive text. So Unklus and Pseudo-Jonathan, for that matter, are type A Targum texts, meaning you seem confused, Esther.
I did. Always exactly the same.
No. What I'm saying is, if you were to strip out any of Unklus's Agadic or Halachic additions, it means that contained within the Targum is the entire biblical text. When you study Rashi, does Rashi comment on every word?
No.
Right. In other words, a type A Targum is continuous biblical text with interpretations added. But when I say interpretation, I mean an expansion. Obviously, when you have a word like Priya Tadar, well, I bet it's not a good example, but when you have certain words, you have to interpret. But you might interpret one for one. But when you get expansions that are clearly not translations of the text, but interpretation, so a type A Targum can be very expansive. It can be not so expansive, but you can always extract the biblical text from it.
It seems very rare that
I don't mean an expansion doesn't have to be, four paragraphs long. An expansion would be three words long also, but it's clearly not part of the biblical text. The people, I asked you to do some unklus for me. So hopefully, not too many of you sent me an email as of early this morning, but maybe some of you have sent since, and a couple of you handed it in. But if those of you who did, the psukim, all right, so can you take examples where unklus didn't translate literally? You did. Okay, so that I could argue is not, that's not an expansion though. And that's Dayanaya, that's that shot, that is literal.
What? I'm
sorry? I think it's interpretation, but I think that's shot. I mean, I think that's a little random, yeah?
The first part that came out, the Gambia, you have the Gambia, it says, literally means his body, he says, means something alone.
But again, I agree, that's not an expansion. That's good that you noticed it. It's important that you noticed it. I don't remember. Does Unklus have it, or that's the Jonas and the audience? Okay, 1 second, I have in front of me. You have it in front of you, too. It's in your packet. I mean,
do we have it?
I have a packet, too. But, okay. No, there's nothing that's necessarily. He interprets. He says, "Lekvar Achran," another person. But again, it's not expansion. What's that? Okay, so that I don't know if I would call that expansion. That's a word that's not there. But if you go to Unklus, if you want to find the easiest way, you do find others. But if you go to Vayechi, Berachas Yaakov, go to Hasinu, go to the poetry, you tend to get much longer expansions in Unklus. You will get, I'm sorry? No, no. You did what you, if you wrote those things. You did. I did three. I said non-literal interpretations. You did. That's correct. I just point out expansions are rare in the list, but you do have them. And Yonah sent them all over the place. You look here. You know every other pasuk has it. But they're both type A targums. If you stripped away expansions, you'd still be left with sort of a one-for-one correspondence to the biblical text. Whereas targum Hashem unless there, if you took away all the, you know, the agadas, you wouldn't be left. You wouldn't be able to have the entire biblical text translated there. Yeah. No, because obviously most of the time Elohim means God. But there are cases it's clear. I mean, it's clear what it means. I agree with you. It is interpretive, but I don't think it's certainly not an expansion. Okay. Yes, Aaron. Mishpatim? Shoftim. No, it's fine. I have also for that. Okay. They're, I'm not saying that there are many places. Umphus rarely gets long expansions, certainly, except for in like the poetry, Hazinu, and maybe out of Hashir Sam, and certainly Berachas Yaakov. But bottom line is that Umphus, with all that, is a fairly literal Targum. Again, literal doesn't mean read Elohim is God. That's still, you know, but there's a very, what we call Peshat oriented, very simple, sort of the straight meaning of the text. The Agada that we find in Unklus is mostly Eretz Yisrael Agada, and the Halacha we find in Unklus tends to conform to that of the Bavli, the Mishnah, and so on. Not always. Now, the question is, now we'll turn our attention to Pseudo-Jonathan. So we spoke about the name as an expansion. We know it's not Yonason from the Megmar Megillah. It is composed in Galilean Aramaic. It's much harder to read than Unklus. I don't suggest you try breaking your teeth on that first. You'll notice also that there are two Targumim that are printed in the side. One's called Yonasem and one's called Yushalmi. They're both Yushalmi Targums, Eretz Yisrael Targums. The one that's called Yushalmi is actually, you'll notice, it's fragmentary. It's only on certain psukim. And in fact, it's not that, I'm not going to discuss anything more than to say, it's not that the Targum, that we only have parts of it. In fact, it appears to be a collection, a manuscript, if I'm not mistaken, which contain Targum for only certain psukim. We call it a fragment Targum, not because we only have fragments left of it, because its original nature seems to have been fragmentary. Its purpose is not entirely clear, but most of the time when you find the fragment Targum, it's almost identical to Targum Yonasan, what's printed as Targum Yonasan. It is very expansive compared to Unklus, certainly, and they say it's about twice as long as the Hebrew text. Although there's obviously a lot of very literal material also, it is still a type A targum. If you strip away the agadic expansions or the halachic expansions, usually agadic, you will wind up with a Hebrew text. There is material in it which is very interesting. I've already recounted to you a number of examples that are against the Mishnah. What does it mean that the Targum translates against the Mishnah? Ayo? Well, no, some of them are not Pshat. Right? Some of them are not even translations. Expansion. Al Kanti Bar Yagi Rachamecha, right? That's not... You don't have to translate at all. You just read. Vitarta O'iza. You know, Yasav Yasbina Lo Tichsun Bi Omachata. That's all you have to do. You don't need to give the Hakdama. So there you can argue you have to interpret one way or the other. Okay, but there are cases. Now, this is an old scholarly question. When something is anti-Mishnaic, what do you think that would imply in terms of the time of origin? Pre or post? Why pre? What's that? Well, the assumption of calling it pre-Mishnaic is because once the Mishnah was sort of published or put out there and it became authoritative, no one would have gone against it. So the tradition has to originate earlier. Does that mean, therefore, that Targum Pseudo-Jonathan predates the Mishnah? Not necessarily. It means these traditions obviously predate the Mishnah, or sections of Targum Pseudo-Jonathan predate the Mishnah. It doesn't mean it all does. Now, I'll tell you, it clearly cannot completely predate the Mishnah because in the pasuk of Akikach lo himo isha me'eretz Mitzrayim, which we read not too long ago, like a week back or so. So when it says that his mother took him a wife from Egypt, it says, I'm sorry, it says, Atikach lo Moshe Meretz Mitzrayim, in Perachav Aleph, Pasuk Chav Aleph, it says, V'yaseh b'madbara deparan yiseh midrapanam, u'niseh itita yas Adisha. His mother married him, a woman named Adisha, who I know nothing about, v'sarcha, and he divorced her, u'nisiva slayim yas Patima. Anyone know who Fatima was? I believe. What's that? Ashish Mohammed. Who's getting married here? Yishmael. When does this paragraph date from? Post Mohammed. This pasuk at least has to date from post Mohammed. It was written in Nebuah. It says that Yishmael. This is the expansion. He married, I don't know who the first one is. Maybe, because I don't know anything about this. I just know there's a famous example. So you know, that's why Fatima. He says he married Adisha and then divorced her, and his mother then found him a wife, Fatima. When the Targum says that Ishmael married a woman named Fatima, who also happens to have been Muhammad's wife, okay, and it's Ishmael, it's very clear this is post-Mohammedan. Unless you think that this was written by Nebuah. No, but where would you get it in the biblical text? What?
They're all called Fatima.
Now they are!
They're called after her.
Like everybody in every child born in Crown Heights in the last 10 years, if he's the first son was called Menachem Mendel.
It's his child, it's not his daughter.
It's his daughter?
It's his sister.
Okay, so that's why.
Husband of Muhammad's only surviving child, Fatima.
Okay, so that's what, where the name is coming from here. Okay? Otherwise, there's no, where else did it come from?
Where did she get her name from?
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. She must have looked in time and Siddur Jonathan before they named her.
Named
what? Guys, wake up and smell the coffee. I understand the name was around, but the fact is, why did the Targum chosen to have incorporated something which doesn't exist in the Midrashim, which is no plausible textual basis for thinking that Ishmael married a woman whose name was Fatima? Why tell us that? The Torah didn't tell us her name. No! So let me explain something to you. Let me explain. This is like Maista Amasul Kabbalah. Right, you find
Muslims.
No, but the point is, here the Torah speaking about the origin, not a Muslim, but the origin from the Muslim perspective. Right, the Torah here is speaking about the origins of the Arabs who are Muslims now. Right, so who is the kind of woman who Yishmael is going to marry?
It's like when they have like the picture books.
Got it. I see you guys, your historical sense needs a little bit of awakening here. You got to think there's nothing in the biblical text or Chazal's tradition that should prompt such an addition to the text. There's nothing in the text that doesn't mention the name.
This is
mother.
What?
There's
nothing that we know of.
So
we're
suggesting
the name. Come on. Just coincidence, right? It's not. Now that doesn't mean, by the way, that the Targum is. We have no theological stake. No matter how who you are, about Uglitz and Yonas and Amat, we have no theological stake about making this Targum 8th century, 1st century, 3rd century. I suspect that if you're very yeshiva, you should probably want to bury the Targum given some of the things it says. My favorite example being the fact that in the 3rd and 6th years. The Targum says, it's called Shnat HaMaaser. Chazal say, the Shana Shlishit is called Shnat HaMaaser. Chazal say, there's only one of the two regular maestros that are no Hega, no Hega, yet. He's only Maestro Rishon, no Maestro Sheni. Targum, Yonas, and the Zion Chumash says that year you give three maestros, Rishon, Sheni, and Ali. Are you sure that one is? Now, I have another other good example than this.
I know the Maestro.
You sure? I didn't know about. Okay. Okay. So anyway, so that is nowhere in Chazal that is held of. A Levi, according to the Yonasan, Kodesh and Hashem goes to the Kohanim. Maaser Behema goes to the Kohanim. But at least Maaser Behema, the Gemara is never explicit. Rashi, Rama, and Tosfos all say Maaser Behema goes to the Bailim. But there is a Qumran tradition that Maaser Behema goes to the Kohanim, and Rabbeinu Chananel also holds that way. It's quoted by the Rashba at the end of Chulin, near the end of Chulin, I think Kuflam and Beis. as quoted in Chiddushei Rashba. So you have many non-standard, almost deviant traditions, halakhic traditions recorded at Gaon HaVilna, okay? But halakhic traditions that are enshrined in Targum Yonah Sefer Nezi'ah. So we have no state. If you want to make the Targum Yonah Sefer Nezi'ah 10th century, I don't think anybody's going to attack you, okay? If you make it post-16th century, then you're a nar, because obviously it was printed already by then. But we don't really care what Targum Yonah Sefer Nezi'ah was composed from a theological perspective. We have nothing to defend it. So once you see the Fatimah in there, that particular expansion is post-Islamic, okay? Anyway, we don't know something. You have to listen. We only work with that which is before us. If I had God come down and send the Yahweh with a signature that this Qasim was composed before Muhammad, then I would accept as something we don't know. We have to work with the text we have in front of us. And given that we don't know what the date of this carbon is, and given that based upon its language, it could range anywhere between the 1st and 10th centuries, probably. And given all that, and that there's nothing in the biblical text that we know elsewhere in the Chazal that speaks about who Shema's wives were, in terms of being insignificant. And we have a name, Fatima, which among Muslims is probably the highest significance, which is Muhammad's sole surviving daughter. And by Chazal Mishma, marrying a woman whom his mother took, how you said, you know, choosing to put that in? I think that's a
He decided
he wanted to give us a name, just like Chazal wanted to tell us who Noah's wife is. So he wanted to tell us who Yishmael's wife was. Well, who is Yishmael's wife going to be? That's what a Bala Gaza does. He's trying to associate Yishmael with Muslims. What? Well, it's there. I just read it.
Bala is actually going to give a name, though.
Well, you want to say that the Targum is all linked. You can say that too.
It's not experience for name.
All I'm saying, Asher, is that that expansion is late. That doesn't mean the entire Targum is about that. That's all I'm saying. It could all be that. It could all be post-Muhammad. But that will pass it, certainly. So this is the issues that scholars grapple with. Is it early? Is it late? You know, well, anti-Mishnaic would seem to be pre-Mishnaic. Maybe it's not. You know, with Muhammad, you know, some references are clearly late additions. Yeah, though. You know, wear me down, yeah. No. Okay. All right. I've spoken about already Tosefta Stetargum. I spoke about the odd examples of Maser Behema and Revai and Maser Oni being the third Maser. Okay, we did that. We spoke about Yonatan. Just Yonatan is very much like Omphalos. It's dead in the Aramaic. It's type A. It's very literal. I've done all of Omphalos more than once. I haven't done Yonatan like that. I've only seen occasional psukim. But my sense is that he's even less expansive than Omphalos. But you know, I haven't studied him on poetry, the few psukim that I've looked at. Okay. On Ksuvim, we have all sorts of targum on Ksuvim. They're not as official. They're not as well established. They are whatever they are. Okay, we'll stop with this. And next week, God willing, you have an exam. 2 weeks from now, we resume talking about targum.